Recording has started.
Great, thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPMs, and All GTLD PDP Working Group call held on Wednesday, the 9th of May, 2018. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the WebEx room. If you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now?
Hi,
your name? Oh, sorry, who was that?
Luca Barbero.
Okay, and anyone else? All right, great. I'd like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleiman. Please begin.
Hi, all. This is Kathy Kleiman, and my co-chair, Phil Corwin, is on the line. And let me stop for thank you for the roll call, Julie, to see if there are any updates to statement of interest. Does anybody, has anyone changed jobs, positions, gotten a huge promotion? Okay, seeing no hands, it's my pleasure to go on to number two of our agenda, the co-chair nomination. As you know, J. Scott Evans resigned due to conflicts with his position at Adobe, and there has been a vacancy for some weeks, and Brian Beckham has been nominated and accepted the nomination to step forward as a third co-chair who, Phil, I don't want to speak for you, but we would welcome because there's a lot of work, and we would love to share it with a third person. Brian, are you receptive? First, are you on the line? And second, are you receptive to taking some questions? And first, would you like to give a little bit of an intro?
Yeah, hi, Kathy. Thanks, everyone. This is Brian Beckham. I am on the line. I apologize. I'm having a little trouble getting into the WebEx, so I'm only on the phone for the moment. I'm trying to get in, but I'm not really an expert on this new form just yet, and fingers crossed we can get Adobe back. In terms of remarks, I don't really have anything particularly that I wanted to add to what I've already said and what others have already said on the list. I know it's been some time, and I apologize for the late hour. It's been quite a hectic day, but I did about 45 minutes ago send an email to the list, which I hope answers the questions that were asked over the past couple days by a couple of working group members. And so maybe what I would like to do is say, to the three individuals who have asked the questions, I hope those are responsive and would happily take any questions that people have. But I feel that those probably do a good job of summarizing my understanding of the questions and my responses. Thanks.
Brian, if I might, this is Kathy, could you review those answers? I've had email problems all day, and I don't know if others have, but if it's gone out just recently, people may be coming in. Is that something, first, it looks like there are people in the queue who want to ask questions. Would you like to summarize your email briefly so that we have it, or my guess is it might be asked again if we don't kind of talk about it all right now?
Yeah. Look, I rather than summarize, because I did take quite a bit of time and put a lot of thought into my responses. And they're not especially short. I tried to be as succinct as possible. Since I'm still having trouble getting into the WebEx, maybe could I propose this? If there are questions people feel are not answered in the written responses, I could try to take those. Now, I'm happy to read my responses into the record, if you will. I'm mindful that could take a little while, and I'm just trying to be as efficient as possible.
Okay. Well, again, since I haven't been able to see your response, is there any way to post Brian's email? This is a question to staff, to post Brian's email in the WebEx so that people can read it if they haven't seen it.
This is Ariel from staff. I can post that in WebEx. Just give me 1 second, and it should be on momentarily.
Terrific. Thank you. And in the meantime, are there – I did see hands raised. It's a little hard in WebEx to figure out what hands are raised. Are there still hands raised?
This is Ariel. There's no hands for now.
There's no hands raised. Okay. Let me give everyone a chance to okay. George, hold on, please. Let me give everyone, now that the email's posted, a chance to read Brian's email. And then, George, I'll go ahead and call on you. Let's take just 1 minute.
George, here. It actually wasn't about
George,
the email. It was about something else, the statement.
Well, okay, let's let people read the email,
okay.
Brian's email.
It's parallel to that.
Hold on just a second, because I'm reading it, too. Okay. Ariel, it looks like there's a second page that will need to be posted as well. Okay, thank you. George, go ahead, please.
George, again, for the transcript. Yeah, all I wanted to do was point out that Zach Muskovich had an updated SOI. I'm not sure if he has the Adobe, WebEx access, but we skipped over that part. So I think he's now with the ICA, and that was just his updated SOI.
Oh, thank you, George. Zach actually updated that in San Juan, but okay, thank you. Let's see. George, if you could take your hand down, please. Does anyone have any further questions, or has Brian addressed them? And Brian, thank you for writing the email that addressed the questions that had been posted per co-chair's request by close of business yesterday. Okay. Mary, if you would, could you walk us through the procedure for approving a third co-chair?
Thanks, Kathy. Hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff. And Julie and I were just chatting about that prior to this call. And if we assume that the custom that has been adopted for all other working groups, even though this is an appointment of a co-chair to replace a co-chair that was initially appointed, would be for the item to be put on the council's consent agenda at its next meeting. And if the group approves Brian's selection, we don't seem to have received any objections. So what you could do, Kathy, is, you know, ask here on the call and again on the list, maybe announce that in the absence of any objections received by today, Brian will, in the opinion of the group, be selected as the third co-chair. We would then suggest that Paul McGrady or you and Phil, as the current co-chair, send a note to the GNSO Council informing them of the fact and asking that confirmation of Brian's appointment be put on the Council's consent agenda for its next meeting.
Terrific, Mary. Thank you for mapping that out. George, is that a new hand?
Yes, it is.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was waiting for Brian's answer to come in before I made an objection, so I just wanted to do that, put forth my objection. It's a symbolic objection because obviously he has the numbers, but I did want to go on the record that I didn't support the candidacy based only on his answer. Thanks.
Okay. Would anyone else like to speak on the issue? We've had a robust discussion on the list, which we all appreciate. That's a great way to use the list, with support and with questions. Brian, is there anything else that you would like to say? And does anyone else want to comment? Either way.
Yeah, Kathy, this is Brian. Thank you. I have to say, I really did put a lot of thought into replying to George's email. I think my reaction speaks for itself. So naturally, I'm a little disappointed to hear an objection. I'd be curious to understand what underpins that, because, like I say, I really did try to put a lot of thought into responding to George's questions. But look, in any event, I understand that everybody has different views, and George is entitled to his. So I'm happy to leave it to the working group to collectively decide the way forward here. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian. Back to you, Mary. In the event of an objection, what would be a good path forward?
Hi, Kathy and everyone. This is Mary again. Certainly, the fact that George has raised this on the call means that it will be documented for the record. Generally speaking, we don't have a lot of procedures for this, but looking at the working group guidelines, even if we were to go forward with an election, the threshold suggested for an election is a simple majority. So from the staff perspective, with one objection and on the record, if the rest of the working group believes, or if at least a majority of the working group does not have any concerns about Brian being put forward, the staff advice is that we can still proceed with George's objection on the record, and we can certainly note that for the council as well.
Makes sense. I'm pausing. Staff, if you see any other hands raised, please let me know. Again, it's hard to see in WebEx, although I don't see any hands raised right now. Let me pause and see if anyone is ready to speak. I see discussion in the chat. So what we could do, again, pausing to see if anyone else wants to speak. Okay. So, Mary, it sounds like what we could do is rephrase slightly and say, in the absence of any further objections, one having been raised, we'll put this out to that it appears, and I'm saying this on the working group, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that Brian has been approved by the vast majority of people attending this call, and that we can put that out to the list. Again, with the notation, you know, in the absence of any further objections, one having been raised, this working group, per this call and then per approval of the list, would like to submit Brian Beckham's name through our liaison, Paul McGrady, to the council for approval as the third co-chair of the Rights Protection Mechanism Working Group. Jeff, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff Newman. I think rather than listing any objections, if we do that, then, you know, it sends a different type of message than we want to send. What we could say is that there was consensus to the selection of Brian, and then if you want George to list George as a minority opinion, I guess, but to just put in the one person that there's an objection doesn't really keep the right picture, unless there's more people that object, of course. So if it's only one person that objects, then that's pretty much consensus.
Terrific. Thanks for your comment, Jeff. Mary, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. And just to clarify, you know, we've been noting the discussion and what you've said to be the summarized next steps forward. One point of clarification from the staff side is that I believe a message had been sent to the working group asking for questions for Brian, as well as any objections to be raised by today. And, of course, we have now noted for the record that George has raised an objection by the time set for such. So our suggestion would be that in the note to the working group, we would say that the one objection has been received, but that we will go forward and send Brian's nomination and selection to the council. So I think that's pretty much what Jeff is saying, but we just thought that we would note that we had asked for questions and objections by today.
Exactly. And I'll just read that. This was in the letter of Friday, number 3. If objections are received or questions submitted that warrant a discussion/response on a call, these will be addressed at the 9 May meeting, at which next steps can also be decided. And so that's what we're working on. Susan, go ahead, please. Susan, I think you may still be on mute. Susan's still not hearing you. Is anybody hearing Susan?
No.
Okay. Susan, perhaps you can dial back in whenever you want to come on. We'll be happy to listen. Okay. Mary, is that Susan? Okay. Alas, I wish we could hear Susan. We'll watch for something in the chat room as well. Mary, I think you've laid a path forward that is consistent with the rules as we know it. Let's follow that. Okay. Terrific. Well, thank you. Can we move back to the agenda? Brian, thank you, and thank you for taking the time to pass a lengthy response and thoughtful response on to the group. And thank you to the people who raised questions by the time deadline, as we requested. And good, we're looking forward to a third co-chair. Our next item on the agenda is the presentation of research from Rebecca Tushnet and the work that's been done with her research assistants at Harvard Law School. Rebecca, are you on the line with us? And staff, could you post the URL? I understand that the spreadsheet is far too big to go into WebEx. And it's also my understanding that Rebecca is walking us through kind of an overall sense of the multiple pages of the research as well as what's on the spreadsheets. So the link has been posted in the chat room. And Rebecca, are you online, please? The floor is yours.
This is Rebecca Tushnet. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Great. Just wanted to make sure that I wasn't having Susan's problem. I hope she'll be with us soon. So I have asked my Chief RA, Alex, to join us in case there are technical questions that she can answer that I cannot. I sent around the URL of the current version. I hope you were able to download it after last week's meeting. And I'm going to just try and give a short overview so there'll be plenty of time for questions and comments, things we should look at differently. So the basic results are we have all the information coded. You can see we have lots of different kinds of information, including the TLD, whether there were multiple domain names involved, where the complainant was from, where the respondent was from, at least where that could be determined, whether the complainant...
Rebecca, may I interrupt? This is Kathy. Which page are you looking at? What's the tab on the bottom, please?
The master. So the second tab, it should say is master enter data. And it goes way beyond, you know, what you could see on one page. So you may have to scroll on the right. But basically, we tried to figure out things that would potentially be of interest, including, you know, whether there was a response when it came in, then the time to decision. Various things about whether it was the domain name was identical to the trademark, whether it was a homophone, whether it incorporated other words, whether the GTLD made a difference to the perception or the likelihood of confusion, whether that was mentioned. If the complaint failed, what was the reason given, so which element turned out to be the problem, and whether we know what happens ultimately. Also, whether anyone mentioned issues with the receiving notice or whether there were language issues. And then we tried to find out whether the domain was active, although our data on that may be a little different. That is, we may not always have the best information. We did try and use the WHOIS data, but we can't be confident that we always got it right. And then also we did some coding in terms of what the examiner found, so what the problems were. So which element of bad faith, for example, was found if that was mentioned. We have some high-level results in the summary tables. showing basically at the big at the highest level who the providers were, what happened. Then we have some specific breakouts, including cases where there were non-English issues, and that's the tab language cases. And you can see it's a relatively small number, but it is it does exist, and there are different issues in terms of translations. Malware.
Okay, hold on. This is Kathy. So we've switched to the tab language cases.
Yes. Language.
And there were about 27 cases, you said, that involved other languages other than English.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
thank
you. Can see it's broken here, broken down by language, and there's anything that the decision disclosed about what was done as a result. So, for example, they found an examiner who can, you know, speak and read Chinese, where the language is Chinese, and so on.
Thank you.
The next tab is, since there's been mention of malware and phishing as an important consideration, we coded whether the presence of malware or phishing was mentioned, and we found three of them out of the total. So that doesn't appear to be playing a large factor in URF decisions. The next tab is complainant analysis, and it shows that there are some really frequent filers. I draw no conclusions from that. It's just something that is worth knowing. We also have...
So now we're on the complaint analysis tab?
Right. So you can see that filed a lot. And then, they represent a little over a third of the total. We also have some data on who the examiners are and how many cases they looked at, in case you're interested in that. We do not have biographical data for them, but we could. We at least know who they are. So let me just say a couple of things that are not explicit, but are evident from once you look at the numbers. First of all, there's a question which I know also arises in the UDRP, which is what is the role of passive holding, where you don't appear to be doing anything with the domain? This appears to be the case with a lot of the defaults, at least where the trademark was famous, that passive holding plus the fame of the mark seems to have been justifying an inference of bad faith in about a third of the cases. Some subset of that third also gives multiple rationales. So not only is there passive holding of a famous mark, but perhaps it was offered for sale. In terms of what we are particularly interested in, 105, about 13% of non-withdrawn cases had no articulated rationale. And the definition here was of whether there was an articulated rationale was basically whether there was kind of a full English sentence saying something like we conclude or the registrant was acting in bad faith because it was attempting to sell the domain, or we conclude that the domain was registered in bad faith because they weren't doing anything with the domain and the mark was famous. So something like that. About 13% of non-withdrawn cases don't have even that, which is something we might want to draw our attention to in the review. In terms of claims that are denied, there's something of, I would say, a trend where the claims are denied a little more earlier in the process, and the rate of claim denial decreases. And again, there are lots of reasons why this might be true, so I don't really draw any conclusions from that. It does appear that earlier in the process, the NEAT classifications were of the registrant or the complainant's mark were more important to the examiners who, although denials of claims are still unlikely, they were more likely when the NEAT classification of the complainant's mark had nothing to do with the GTLD.
Rebecca, there's a question. This is Kathy. There's a question. It may be an old question. Which tab are we on?
I'm sorry. So this is really the big master table, sort of what you can get from looking at from selecting cases in the big master table.
Okay. Apologies for interrupting. Go ahead.
No. So in terms of examiner level data, the issue of not writing anything may actually vary by examiner. So there are a few who never write anything, and again, that may be something where we might want to focus our recommendations. Descriptive data, just of interest, it appears that the registrants come mostly from the U.S. and China. The U.S. seems to be more dominant by number of cases, while China is more dominant by number of domains. And again, I draw no prescriptive conclusions from that. That's just sort of what we're seeing. So I think with that, I would like to go to any questions, clarifications, anything people want to add.
Great. Rebecca, thank you for this overview. And before I call on Barry and George and whoever else is in the queue, I'm getting emails publicly and privately that people are looking at this for the first time. And, Rebecca, I wanted to share that with you. And that's exactly what we were thinking. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the ICANN world as well as in our professional lives and our personal lives. Part of what we're doing here, and, Rebecca, please correct me if I'm wrong, is you were providing an overview. We may be taking the next few weeks off. So an overview and introduction to the data, to the various sheets. And I'm not, this isn't a formal invitation, but were people to have further questions, would you be willing to come back and join us and discuss this further after they have a chance to look at the data?
Of course.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Barry, let me go on to you. I know there's some issues about the who is data, and you're going to tell us which column that's in, and that's the data you provided to Rebecca. Go ahead, Barry.
Thank you, Kathy. Barry Cobb for the record. I just wanted to further elaborate on what Rebecca had mentioned, referring to the master tab of the spreadsheet. On column Alpha O, or Alpha Oscar AO, through Alpha Romeo are especially those two columns. So basically those are data coding that was automated based off a fetch of who is records for each of the domain names across all of the cases. For those that have reviewed the 14 appeals from, I think that was presented prior week, there was one component to that review of the appeals that talked about the final domain disposition, and the idea was to get an understanding of where today that domain, you know, what the status of that domain was. For example, was it still resolving to the suspension servers? Is it available for registration? Did the brand owner pick it up through either themselves or through their brand protection company, or whatever the other outcomes were? Because we're dealing with 1,800 cases here, it would be a monumental task to try to do that manually. And so Rebecca and her team automated that. And as Maxim pointed out, the very last tab of the spreadsheet is that raw data and where some of that coding exercise occurred. So I just want to point out that if the working group does choose to use any part of this data, that you hold off on this purple section, again, column Alpha Oscar, because it's not fully accurate, or it's accurate. Accuracy is only as good as the WHOIS data that was provided. Specifically, when I went to go fetch that data, I didn't get a fresh query. Instead, I've got the last known historical record that had been captured and thus is not properly reflect that final domain disposition as of today. And if there are any other questions, I can answer that if need be. Thank you.
Sure. Barry, I have a question. This is Kathy. Stand on the line, please. Thank you for the description. You're talking about column AO under result and final disposition. Great. Thank you for identifying that. You said something about 1,800 cases. Let me just double check. I think we're in the 800 case range, but it's 1,800 domain names. Is that right? Because multiple domain names can be reviewed in a single URS case. Just wanted to check.
Yes, that's correct. Apologies if I misspoke. That's 1,800 domain names across 750 cases. I forgot what our final number is.
Terrific. Thank you. let me pause. Well, I guess it's hard to do with the queue, but if people have questions for Barry, of course, you know, please ask. George, go ahead, please.
George Gregos for the transcript. Yeah, thanks for doing this research. And for highlighting the non-use passive holding stuff, as well as the cases that didn't have any articulated rationale for their decisions. My broader question is, usually when this kind of academic research is done, there's a line in the last paragraph that says something like, you know, the need for additional research is evident. So I was wondering, in terms of going forward, how can we, you know, being, you know, this PDP and I can help in terms of data in the future, what kind of data do you wish you had when you did this research? Like, you have to go with what is actually available, but what kind of data did you wish you had available? Thank you.
This is Rebecca Tashnet. Thank you. I guess so. One thing, obviously, coming out of a tradition which prioritizes reasons for decisions, you know, I wish that the examiners had all given reasons for their decisions. And I conclude that this is a recommendation that I would like the working group to pursue, that there be at least basic statements of reason for decision. You know, for example, the element of or bad faith that was found in a case where there was bad faith found, or in a case where the complaint fails, identification of which prong failed. And it turns out that not all the claim denies actually do that. So for, you know, both sides, it would seem to be useful to require something, you know, and not necessarily very much. But, you know, based on the evidence presented, bad faith was found in the form of, you know, X. And then the other thing, which is also true of any study of decisions, is that a study of decisions is itself inherently limited to a special subset of people, sort of those who decide to fight over it. So in one sense, the best data would cover all the domain names that are registered in new GTLDs and do some sort of analysis of them, including the ones that maybe are infringing but aren't found, and we might want to know, you know, how many consumers find them. That would require a lot of resources, and I don't know anyone will ever be able to do that. The other aspect here that I think is important is, you know, the effect of the TMCH and the claims notice on sort of what gets to this point at all. So we do know that lots of people drop out, and we don't know what percentage of those would have ended up, you know, losing these cases had they been brought versus the percentage who would have ended up with something that actually was perfectly legitimate. And so that's kind of the people who don't litigate or the people who don't arbitrate are kind of the key missing data here. And you'd have to do a completely different kind of research to find them. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Rebecca. Thanks for the question, George. The queue is Maxim, Susan, and we have a question from David McCauley that just came in the chat room. Maxim, go ahead, please.
Maxim, although for the record, I suggest that this particular file is reformatted to remove personal data of subjects because it's not going to be safe in 2 weeks. And, for example, the person named someone is like person one, and his email or her email is email one. And also the same for the phones and faxes. That's it. It's my suggestion. It will not change anything because you will be able, yeah, the same for address. You will be able to know the country, maybe that it's the same person. So it's basically the same person did registrations of all those domains, for example. But in my opinion, it will not remove any useful bits, but it will make it usable for us after GDPR comes into force. Thanks.
Good point, Maxim. Thank you. And I assume you'll be let me ask, would you be able to answer questions if Rebecca has them offline? Because I know you're doing a lot of work on the GDPR, Maxim. So is that something you could take offline and help her
yes.
with the columns that should be
yes.
redacted?
Yes. Okay. I will help. My email is I will answer the questions and I will help if it's needed. Thanks.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm looking at the queue. It's hard to tell. But apologies ahead of time, guys. It's hard to tell order. Adobe was much better on the order. So I'm going to stick with the original order and then add Cynthia and Paul Keating. Susan, go ahead, please.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Good. Thank you.
Good.
Okay. Thanks very much. Rebecca, I just had a couple of questions. I was trying to understand which of the tabs was the one that deals with the rationale or lack thereof, I wonder if you can help me because I was looking at the one called complainant analysis, and that does have a heading in kind of row three that says examiner comment analysis, did examiner explain evidence/rationale, but the rest of the tab I don't really understand in that context, and I'm not sure if maybe that's a rogue heading, or is that table, are all of those cases where there's no rationale? I may be misunderstanding, so apologies.
Susan, this is Rebecca Tashnet. If you scroll past case analysis, which in my version shows up as a set of orange topped columns, look past result and final disposition, which in my version is purple. If you go further to calculated fields, you should see a lot more detailed classification of the different things that are discussed in the decision. And you can see they're coded as true or false. So I believe that's what you're looking for. Please let me know if that is insufficient. Thank you.
Okay, so back to my question then. So the data for that, it's on this master enter data tab then. Is that's I'm assuming that's the one you're referring to rather than the tab that's called complainant analysis?
Yeah. Master data columns, this is Kathy, AUAVAW.
Okay. And then could I just ask then a question about the actual lack of a rationale?
Go ahead.
Is what you're saying, Rebecca, that essentially there's nothing, there's just a decision that goes like, you know, like I kind of find for the complainant, or is it, I'm satisfied that the domain was registered in bad faith, but there's nothing to explain why I, the examiner, am satisfied. You may well have explained this, but would you mind just explaining it again so I kind of understand the level of lack of rationale?
Sorry, this is Rebecca Teshnet. So some examiners never write anything. What we coded as lack of rationale. Well, let me ask Alex. Alex, if you're on, maybe you could step in and give a couple of examples of where you drew the line, just so I don't misstate anything. Are you on, Alex?
Yes, sure thing. Hi, my name is Alex Dunan. I'm Rebecca's research assistant, and I did a lot of the work on this file. If you go to the very first tab, it's called Fields and Methodology. I wrote a little something about the types of cases that we coded as a yes for when the examiner failed to articulate an evidentiary basis. If you go to that very first tab, it's called Fields and Methodology, and you scroll down to the orange section, and it's the very first row in that orange section. So I wrote, we reserved a no for these cases for cut and paste copying. So if the examiner literally just pasted the three prongs of the URS, like, you know, oh, in bad faith, A, B, C, D, they just pasted it, but they made no determination. Like they did not even bother to say, this is a passive use case. They just pasted it. We said they failed to articulate a basis. And occasionally they will just flat copy and paste it. And they will sometimes articulate a bad faith prong, but only in the sense of like bolding the prong that they think was bad faith, or they'll just write 1.2.6.3a. But they don't explain anything else. And these cases also often have no summary of even the facts of the case. So I couldn't even figure out kind of what had happened with the domain, but we were fairly conservative with these. So if you even bothered to write at the bottom, I'm convinced based on the behavior of the respondent that this is a case of bad faith, we marked that as having provided some detail. It was a pretty conservative column. And if you, I think the original tab that you're referring to where it talks about I think I called it examiner analysis case, you can see that most of the folks who kind of declined to provide any detail, it's like a couple of repeat offenders. But there are some people who just provide no detail, but we were fairly conservative with this column. So I hope that helps. I'm happy to answer any other questions about it, but that was kind of our method.
Great. Thank you, Alex, and thank you for being on this call today. This is Kathy, of course. To Phil's note in the chat, just something to think about since we do seem to have a number of people who have their hands raised, so a question of balancing. I promised to read David McCauley's question, and he says, Rebecca, whoops, somebody just posted, and so I lost it. Apologies going back. Rebecca, just curious if you know, did examiners stick to one URS provider, or did they provide examiner services through more than one provider? I'd be interested, for example, if an examiner gave reasons for one provider but not for another.
Actually, I don't think we did that analysis. I think it would be possible to do. I can ask Alex to do that because she knows how to manipulate the cells and see if there's any difference. Alex, do you know offhand?
I don't know offhand, but if that's pretty easy to do, I could do it right after the call in about 10 or 15 minutes.
Cynthia, you were in the queue. Are you still interested in asking a question? I don't see your hand raised. It looks like no. Okay. Then we've got Paul Keating and George Kirkius. And I'd urge you to be brief so that we can move on to the URS proposal. And we note that Rebecca will be willing to return and talk about the data further. Paul, go ahead, please.
Yes, this is Paul Keating for the record. I just wanted to respond to the comment about the GDPR. I don't see this as a problem, Rebecca. All of the respondents are registrants of a domain name. They have, by contract, agreed to this process, and the rules are hyperlinked into the registration agreement. So any appearance of their personal information in the URS or UDRP decision is by consent. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Paul. George, briefly, please.
Yes. Long ago, I proposed that UDRP or URS decisions be available in XML format, like a machine-readable format, for the ease of academic research. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how much this kind of research costs you in terms of time and money and manual entry of data, et cetera, and how much time and money you would have saved had the decisions, et cetera, been available through machine-readable formats. Thank you.
And Rebecca,
I'm going to briefly
Yeah,
okay. I'm going to just because she is, so it is her work and her labor that is at issue here. So, Alex, do you have any thoughts?
So XML would have been incredible. Barry did a great job pulling a lot of these fields for us, so some of them were easily scrapable, but there are some that were better. Important that weren't. So it took a lot of time to paste in the representative information, the country information. That kind of stuff is interesting. Like, I would have expected a lot of these to be coming from China, but as a matter of fact, a lot of them are coming from the United States. That kind of stuff was valuable but really hard to get. On average, it took me approximately 6 minutes to code each one of these. And because the decisions are so short, a good bit of that was copying and pasting of stuff that actually wasn't academic work. So I think in the end, it was a substantive effort, but XML would have been incredible and made it so much easier.
Great. Thank you, Alex. And George, Paul, if you could put your hands down, please, you would do that by tapping the hand again. Great thanks to Rebecca and to Alex for coming on the call, for walking us through this data, and for the comprehensive data that every case has been analyzed. Rebecca, could you tell us briefly to what date every case has been analyzed?
This is Rebecca Teschen. I believe it was, was it December 17th? December sometime. I'm sorry, don't have the date.
Just wondering. Thank you. I'm putting you on the spot on that. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the data. Thank you for the discussion today. Now, moving on, I'm going to close item number 3 and move on to item number 4, which I know a number of people want to talk about, the discussion of URS Phase 2 proposal. I note that we have 40 minutes for this discussion, and this is the proposal John McElwain submitted to the working group, and I am actually going to call first on Phil Corwin, my co-chair, to talk a little bit about the research that staff and co-chairs have been doing on the charter, on what goes into Phase 1 and Phase 2, and some of the flexibility that we have in terms of going forward. Phil, would that be appropriate? Would you like the floor?
Yes. Thank you very much, Kathy. And I wonder if staff could temporarily take away John's original proposal and put up the text of the email that was sent out to all working group members the other day regarding the analysis of the charter language conducted by the co-chairs and staff. Is that available?
This is Marilyn from staff. I'm going to post that momentarily.
Thank you. And as soon as that's up, I'll be very brief in hitting the high points, and then I know that John McElwain's on the call and is probably going to want to speak to this, and then we can open it up to further discussion. Just waiting for the document. I'm going to I've got that email.
Posted,
what's that?
It was just posted.
Oh, okay. Okay. We're not going to go through all of this, but basically, you know, it's interesting when you think you know what something says and then you actually take a close look with a lawyer's eye at it, it's more revelatory and revelatory, I mean. And so the quick analysis of what the charter actually says and what we would need to do to fulfill its requirements in regard to URS and what flexibility it permits us in regard to URS. The chart is quite clear that phase one needs to focus on a review of all the RPMs that develop the new TLD program. Of course, URS is one of those new RPMs, and the requirement is that we focus. Well, certainly, I think with the work of the sub-teams to develop practitioner and provider questions and whatever discussion we have when we get those answers back in the next 4 to 6 weeks, and we'll probably satisfy the focus requirement. Then it says at a minimum in each phase, that's phase one and two, we have to assess the effectiveness of the relevant RPM. So we need to include in the initial report at least some evaluation, some assessment of the effectiveness of URS and whether it's meeting its intended purpose in a proper way. Then there's some additional language highlighted about that it has to contain any preliminary recommendations. Doesn't say we have to put all preliminary recommendations, although I would say personally that given their importance to a subsequent round of TLDs, if we're going to recommend any changes in the other non-URS RPMs, we should get those out before another round launches. Also, the initial report has to highlight any issues or recommendations that the group thinks should be considered by the subsequent procedure group, or that the working group considers relevant to its work in phase two. And then it also says that in phase two, we're also expected to review the first initial report and consider feedback, et cetera. So we can return to phase one issues in phase two under that language. So the bottom line here is that if we don't change the charter, we need to focus on URS in phase one, and given the work we've already done and the follow-up review of the questions we put out, we certainly have focused on URS. We have to include an assessment of its effectiveness, and we probably would want to include some recommendations where I personally would favor, if we find administrative problems, providers not following the rules, rules and procedures that don't make sense, that there's a consensus they don't make sense and ought to be changed. Those should be in phase one. But on other policy issues, I would say if we have ready consensus, we can include them. But if we decide that that a policy issue should be deferred and looked at again in phase two because of unknown effects of GDPR enforcement, or because we believe it's intimately involved with our consideration of the UDRP, or simply because we can't yet reach consensus, we have flexibility under this charter to defer making a recommendation or failing to make one, and simply put those URS issues over to phase two. That's the general reading of the charter. So it does have certain requirements we have to meet. It does give us some flexibility on collectively deciding which, if any, issues we want to defer to phase two and come back to. And if we decide to act in that way and kind of manage this ourselves and not give further consideration to whether or not we should make a formal request of GNSO counsel for a charter change, we avoid probably the necessity to pull this full working group because the opinions were fairly well divided last week. Then we avoid the debate on what level of support versus what level of opposition is required to request a charter change, and then we avoid the debate on what, if we agree that there's sufficient support to forward a request to council, we'd have to get into, well, what exactly should that request say? So we can do a little more URS work, decide how much more we want to do, and avoid all of that and manage this ourselves, hopefully in a respectful and constructive way that gets done what we can do in phase one and defers what should be deferred to phase two under the current charter. So I'm going to stop there. That's the general reading of the co-chairs and the staff when we review and parse the exact language of the charter. And now we're going to open it up to further discussion where you're free to advocate taking that route or to advocate for a charter change or against a formal charter change. And I don't know if John McElwain wanted to speak because it was his original proposal that has gotten us into this discussion. And so let's see if he wants to speak and any other working group member wants to speak.
Thank you, Phil.
So this is John McElwain for the record. I will just make a few statements there. I think that it is a good idea to have some discussion on today's call about being able to handle a decision on the URS being moved to phase two or having certain parts of it deferred without going to necessarily having to do a charter sort of having that re-looked at by the GNSO Council. But I would point out that there was really two components to the proposal. One was that we didn't want to spend a lot of time on the URS when many of its issues were either very applicable to the UDRP or there would be a big question mark because of GDPR. If I'm hearing that we can defer certain portions of that to a phase two, then I think that solves the issue that I had identified. And really, I don't think anybody had spoken up in it that we were wrong. I think everybody was in agreement that GDPR is going to impact the URS and the UDRP, and that the URS and the UDRP have certain elements and procedures that are similar and would benefit having looked at together. But the other part to the proposal was to say, how can we make some improvements to the working group? So, you know, in order to really holistically discuss this idea of sending the working group charter back to the council, we need to tackle that other issue. And I think we could also do that within this working group. But I guess in order for me to feel comfortable that the proposal wasn't being dismantled, we need to hear some support whether we could, within this working group, look at how can we improve and how can we scope out our work and how can we develop processes that allow us to work towards a common goal of finishing the goals and objectives of the working group. So with that, I'll be quiet and let other folks have the floor. Thank you.
Kathy, if I could just jump right back in and then very quickly.
Okay. Co-chair's prerogative. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah. Well, just to segue from what John just said, he and I had the opportunity for some interaction yesterday to discuss this analysis. And one thing we had discussed, which I hope working group members would further discuss once I stop talking, is that because the second half of this year will be extremely important for this working group, where we really go from the analysis phase to the decision-making phase, and we're aiming to get an initial report out late this year or in the first quarter of 2019, that in the spirit of what full council did in San Juan, we might devote one of the three 90-minute sessions in Panama to a full and frank discussion of how we can operate in the most constructive and productive manner possible in the second half of 2018 to get as much constructive work done in this working group as we can. So I'd like to tee that up both. What I heard John say was that he'd be comfortable with withdrawing his request for a consideration of a charter change request and work rely on the maturity of this working group to manage URS issues itself as we go forward, if he can get some assurance that we'll also in some way tackle the need to have a discussion of how to work constructively in the end phase of section, the end of phase one. So I'm going to stop there and step back and look forward to further discussion by the working group. Thank you.
Okay. In the interest of fairness, John, do you want to, this is Kathy, of course, do you want to respond and then we'll go into the queue? I mean, do you want to comment, respond?
Hi, Kathy. Yeah, John McElroy. No, I think that that sums it up quite well. The proposal was to, again, address those two issues, moving at least some aspects of the URS to phase two and to address scoping of our working group charter. It can be, I don't care how that's done. If we can do it within this group, that's fantastic. But if we don't have support, then I think, the original proposal would stand. Thanks.
Okay. And so then revisiting the thought that we would spend one of our valuable and important 90-minute sessions going through a full and frank discussion of the issues of process and procedure that John raised has been offered and is supported by staff and co-chairs. Quick note, hold Thursday of the Panama City meeting. It looks like most of our sessions, well, at least two out of three will be on the Thursday. I don't have the date in front of me. Thursday of that meeting, the last day, so please stay all the way through the meeting. The cue that I have is Susan George Paul. Go ahead, please, Susan.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I've been relatively supportive of the idea of seeking this charter amendment, but I mean, I would sort of agree with John that I don't think anyone wants a charter amendment for the sake of a charter amendment. It was the belief that it was necessary to seek a charter amendment. So I mean, if we feel that we can adequately do our work within the scope of the charter as it currently exists and address the URS properly, within phase one and or phase two, then I'd be perfectly happy with that. I guess I'm just at the moment I'm a little uncertain of how we can do that, in the sense that the phase one part talks about at a minimum each phase the working group's expected to assess the effectiveness of the relevant RPMs, and so that means clearly we need to in phase one assess the effectiveness of the URS. But it seems to me that in order to have done that, we effectively have to have done a full review of the URS. And we, as we've been talking about, there are some issues, including the significant potential impact of the GDRP that surely means that we can't do that assessment because there's a kind of moving target happening. So I'm not raising an objection. I guess I'm asking for some guidance on how we can do that. If in fact we can't complete our work, how can we do an assessment of the effectiveness?
Good question. Thank you, Susan, in inviting responses to that. I have Paul Keating next. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Paul Keating. First, the way I see this charter in its text, I don't see there's necessarily an issue for us in terms of how we want to, what order we want to take specific issues. granted that there is this language at a minimum in each phase, we'll assess the effectiveness of the relevant RPM. So I guess as I originally saw John's email, it seemed like there were two issues there. One was let's not deal with issues in the URS that we're going to deal with in the UDRP because it would be duplicative. And the other one was an issue about how many chairs we have. The issue of duplication, I mean, I don't see if there's an issue that's truly duplicative, and the URS is duplicative of exactly what the problem is or what the issue being considered is in the UDRP, then in the UDRP in phase two, we can rely on what we concluded and what we investigated relative to the URS. We don't have to repeat that work. So whether we do it now, whether we do it later, we're still going to have to do the same amount of work. The assessment of the effectiveness of the URS as an RPM, I'm not certain I see how just addressing that issue or that investigation necessarily impacts on the UDRP, okay? And lastly, I don't for the life of me understand this concern about the GDPR and its application to this process. The only relevant issue is the access by panelists to who is records for the purposes of understanding who the respondent is. The rest of the issues are practitioner issues in terms of investigation, et cetera, leading up to the URS. But in terms of the personal identifiable information that might be contained in any particular URS decision, which is the only thing that is published, I just can't see the issue at all because it's consented to, because we all have to agree to this dispute mechanism, and without your information, we can't that part of the contract cannot be complied with. So if someone would please explain to me what we're talking about in terms of the GDPR, I would greatly appreciate it. And I'll end my comments there. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Paul. And I noticed that John, who I'm not calling on yet, is in the queue and may be in a position to do that. I believe the queue is, I try to watch hands as they're going up, George, David, John, Maxim. George, go ahead, please. Somewhat briefly, if everyone could. Thank you. Because we've got about 20 minutes left on the call and important things to discuss. George, go ahead, please.
George Krikos for the transcript. I oppose both elements of this proposal, the structure of the chairs. I don't think it needs to be changed. And also the timeline of the work. We agreed on a timeline early on, and the main part of our work involves data collection and then analysis. And we've already done, or we're in the process of doing the data collection for the URS. Also for the TMCH, the data should be coming in at some point soon. So none of this is going to change with the GDPR. In fact, if we actually justified it using GDPR, then you'd want to delay even further because you'll say, well, we want to have 2 or 3 years of experience with the GDPR to figure out what the impact of the changes are. And, that'll delay the work even more. So I think we should stick to the plan now, because there could also be, other countries doing legislation. Like, the world is always changing, so we have to do the analysis with what we've got at the time of the analysis of the work. Furthermore, I'm a little bit concerned about how this topic, which is basically a whole process change, came to the top of the agenda, because folks like me come to this PDP week after week, and we ask for things like, where are the top TMCH 500 terms from the prior research? Like, I've been asking for that.
George, with respect, I think we're moving off topic.
But my point is that this came to the top of the agenda and used staff resources and co-chairs' resources, whereas data requests from folks like me who want the data to actually do the work are being delayed indefinitely, it seems. And this, is relatively a procedural work thing, whereas we're actually looking for the data to do the actual work. So I don't know how staff resources are being allocated to this.
Okay, understood. A lot of TMCH data is being collected now. Let's go back and see if
the top 500 terms I'm talking about from the analysis group.
That's TMCH. Okay.
Yeah.
We don't even know if they have those, but different issue. We're talking about URS. So thank you. Any more comments on the URS, or can we move to the – appreciate your thoughts. Can we move on to the queue? Okay, David McCauley, please.
Kathy, thanks. David McCauley speaking. Hello, everyone. And when this came up, I expressed some personal reservations on seeking the charter change, et cetera, that were on the list, and I think I've mentioned here on the phone before. But now we've had some fairly rigorous analysis and review by the co-chairs and staff, for which I'm very grateful. Thank you. And so I think I would like to say that I tend to agree with where I think the co-chairs and the staff are going on this. And to some degree, I may disagree a little bit with Susan, and I think that this is possibly divisible on analyzing the effectiveness of URS. And I think it's along the lines that Phil may have mentioned about looking at operational administrative matters in phase one, and there may be an issue like a policy issue, such as whether URS should be subject to consensus policy that would be more, perhaps more easily done in phase two. So that's where I stand on things right now. I think we're It almost falls along the line that John Nevitt suggested when John made his original proposal and then some people opposed it, and John made a compromise position. Why don't we do the administrative kind of things in phase one and the others in phase two? I think it is divisible. It could be. We could scope it out in Panama. And so that's what I wanted to express now. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Not indivisible, but divisible. Thank you. John, I believe you're next. And David, thanks for mapping out a route. And I did try to I did ask John Nevitt if he would be on the call today, and unfortunately, he has a conflict. John McElwain, go ahead, please.
Hi. Well, John McElwain for the record, and I hope to be able to at least take one thing off of everybody's plates. It's really important for people to remember that my proposal that has nothing to do with the structure of the co-chairs. It is an email that I sent to Paul Tattersfield on April 13th at 1:34 p.m. Paul, sorry for not responding sooner. It's important to note that my last comment is A, unrelated to the proposal, and B, primarily to point out the structural issues that I personally perceive in the current setup of the working group. So what I probably never should have included that at the end, but what I wanted our fine co-chairs to know is that I think that the current setup is not ideal, and I was going to personally work towards a change in that regard, and I didn't want them to think that it was any sort of backstab. That's the only reason why I put that in the original proposal. It's been brought up every call. People are apparently not reading emails or my emails, but it is certainly not part of the proposal. Second thing is, just again, reference the emails. We've set forth in a number of emails all the different ways that GDPR is going to impact the procedure and the substance of a URS or a UDRP proceeding. So, Kathy, thank you very much.
John, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for putting your hands down. Maxim, you are next, please.
Maxim Malzoba, just short notice. So the PDP members can understand why everybody is talking about GDPR. Basically, in 2 weeks, most registries and registrars will publish no personal information. It means no emails, no names, no registrant IDs, no addresses. Maybe country, maybe city. That's it. So all procedures which require anything from this list, basically we will have issues with them. For example, even simple transfer of domains is going to be an issue. Thanks.
Maxim, before you leave the call, though, do you think the data will be provided by registrars, say, to dispute resolution providers for the purpose of contacting the registrant and providing them notice about a URS proceeding?
I am not sure. I think this question should be addressed to contracted party house because I cannot speak for all of registrars and all of registries.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that, yes, it's relevant to our discussion. Thanks.
Okay. Before I call on Paul, with my co-chair's hat on, this is Kathy, of course, it looks like we're moving towards agreement, I believe. I don't want to push it to consensus yet, but agreement that there are issues of the URS we can
look at today, especially with the data being collected from the practitioners and the documents in the provider subteams, as well as the data Rebecca has shared, and but also policy issues that may be intertwined, more closely intertwined with the EDOP that can be postponed later, and that could be a decision we make as we go into the summer, which isn't very far away, and have the materials in front of us. That's my sense of the conversation. Paul, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I understand that I had a long period of absence from this work group because I had a very serious injury, but I'm now back. My apologies having been made before. I did keep up with emails, and I'm struggling with the reasons for why we're going out of order, an order that we all agreed to in the beginning. If it's duplicative work, I don't see what the reason is for kicking the can down the road instead of dealing with it now and relying on our work that we've already done once we get to phase two. So far, the only reason that I've heard enunciated in the email from John and during this work group is GDPR. Okay? And again, I've worked with lots of registrars and registries and registrants on GDPR issues. And the issue from a URS point of view is notification to the respondent. If the email is not published because the person opts out or the registrar opts out of providing that data in WHOIS, they will still maintain a process of connecting and contacting the respondent and the registrar. So the registrar will receive notice and respond or not respond. Okay? So I'm failing to understand how GDPR, which is a rule of law in Europe, which has been on the books for over 4 years in essence, and we all had notice of this version of GDPR, which really doesn't change much other than making it more clear. I don't see why this is suddenly brought up as a reason to wait because, lo and behold, something's going to change, right? I don't see how that, I mean, even if it were subject to change,
great.
We can deal with that in the context of the report. So I don't see why this is, I don't see how this is a rationale for kicking this can down the road instead of tying into it and actually doing the work that we need to do to complete the URS as phase one.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Understood. Let's see. Phil has posted in the chat, the default position is that if we can't agree on an issue, I assume we're talking about a URS issue, then we likely lack consensus and there will be no recommendation in the initial report. And it will be, or probably may be, deferred for resolution in phase two. That seems to be, you know, specific issues aside, including the GDPR, could someone mute, please? Specific issues aside, including the GDPR, that seems to be where we are on the URS issues overall. With 10 minutes left in the call, I just wanted to see, it looks like there's general agreement on that we continue the work that we're doing and also schedule for Panama City with an absolute commitment that we work on the procedural issues that John has raised and that we hold a full session on that in Panama City, a face-to-face session. Does anyone else want to comment on this? Terrific. Have I missed anything in the chat room that anyone would like to raise, you know, speak on the phone? Terrific. Then I think, you know, with thanks to John for raising issues, I think we're ready to move on. What I'm hearing, and of course we'll put it out on the list, is that we're ready to move on with our existing work and later decide what issues might be moved to phase, what policy issues might be moved to phase two for consideration with the UDRP. Okay. In that case, staff, our next agenda item is, I think, talking about not holding meetings for the next 2 weeks, given the the upcoming GDD in Vancouver and the INTA meeting in Seattle. But let me call on Julie or Mary to tell us a little bit more about that. And I think we're supposed to poll people about the status of meetings for May 16th and 23rd. But let me hand it over to you, and you have more than a minute. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This is Julie Headland from staff, and so we've noted in our in sending around the agenda for this meeting today, we did ask for availability for the next couple of weeks because we do have, as you noted, Kathy, quite a few various conflicts, and let me just remind you all of them again. And of course, now I can't get my email to come up. So the two meetings in question are the next Wednesday, which is the 16th, and the 23rd, which is then the 23rd. And so we've got a couple of different. Conflicts for the next few weeks. We have not only the GDD summit, we also have the RightsCon, and we, in addition, we have. In addition, we have INTA. So GDD Summit and RightsCon conflict with the working group meeting on the 16th, and the INTA meeting conflicts with the working group meeting on the 23rd. And we did not get a response to our request along with the agenda if working group members could indicate their availability for those dates. But we do expect that quite a few working group members will be conflicted on those dates because of those meetings. So the suggestion was that the working group consider not holding meetings on those two dates. So I think that's where we stood, Kathy, but let me know if staff has missed anything.
Right. And, John, I know you put your hand up. Is it to talk about the meetings on the 16th and the 23rd?
No, Kathy, sorry. I couldn't get my hand up earlier.
Okay. Could you hold on a second then?
Yeah,
let's finish this item. And then. Okay. Does anybody have any objection to not holding meetings for the next 2 weeks? There will be a group at the GDD Summit and an even larger group, I think, at the INTA meeting, which I will be attending for the first time.
Kathy, this is Julie from staff. Just to note that there's a question from Susan in the chat asking the timing of the meeting on the 23rd. So the timing of that meeting would be the same time as this meeting, so that would be 1700 UTC. And just so that everybody knows, the final meeting at the end of the month is always at the APAC time, which is 1200 UTC on that for some people, that would fall then on the Thursday, actually, I think. Still also on the 30th, but 1200 UTC, so the earlier time.
But, Julie, let me, this is Kathy. I think we're not having a meeting on the 23rd, so it wouldn't be at the regular time. It would be canceled because so many people will be in Seattle from the working group. And so you're saying the 30th meeting will be at our new, let me check, will be at our new Asia-friendly time, which is, sorry, guys, I don't convert well to UTC, but it's 8 a.m. Eastern time.
Yes.
Okay. Terrific. George, did you want to speak to that, or did you want to speak to something else?
George, I'd like to speak to this. I think it would be better if we actually do go ahead with the meetings, even if they're going to have lighter attendance. Like we've dealt with lighter attendance in the context of the APAC meetings already, and we do get work done on the list. Like my fear is we keep delaying the work because we skip meetings, for example, before and after ICANN events. And so we kind of lose hours here and there, and the efficiency of the work in terms of the number of meetings versus the number of weeks gets really bad. So here's my suggestion. If a lot of people are going to be in a certain time zone, why don't you just pick a time that doesn't conflict with events in that time zone? So let's say if it's in Seattle, you schedule it for 9 p.m. in Seattle, and people that want to attend you know, it doesn't conflict with their work. It might conflict with their entertainment, but they can all attend if they, you know, prioritize this working group. And the people that aren't in attending those meetings can still continue on with the PDP's working work. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. John, I think your hand's up for something else. Julie, is your hand up?
It is, Kathy, and this is Julie Hedlund from staff. So just one thing for the working group to consider, and I know you probably were going to mention this too, Kathy, but we have, some work that is happening right now that actually doesn't require meetings, and that is that the sub-teams had prepared and the working group had agreed to the questions to the providers and to the practitioners. And those are, in the works and out there and, in data gathering mode, but there's nothing for the working group to do while those inquiries are underway until the data starts coming back, and none of that data will come back for the 16th or the 23rd. Point that out, I don't think there was anything, any action items at this time on the working group to proceed with that might be missed if we canceled those meetings, but I'll defer to the co-chairs on that.
Thank you, Julie, for that background, and good point. Now that we've pushed so hard to get these surveys out, and a lot of people did a lot of work on Fridays late at night to try to finalize those questions in the sub-teams, which we appreciate, that they're out there and we're waiting for that data to come back. So, John, again, happy to – I'm going to call on you in just a second. Does anyone else object to not holding meetings on the 16th and 23rd to kind of allow people to attend their meetings in peace or travel back travel back on, say, that Wednesday from Seattle? Okay, looking for hands, looking for comments. Okay, John, go ahead, please. You're taking us back to item number 4. Is that right?
Yes, I am. So I just wanted to, and John McWayne for the record, I want to just put an offer out there on the table in that I would be happy to sort of put together a revised proposal along the lines we've discussed today. I think it would be best to work on that with staff because I think they helped draft that aspect as to what's permissible under the charter, and I would send that to the co-chair leadership. Would that be a nice to-do list over the next week or two with respect to my proposal?
Let me. There are people in the queue. Let me ask. Let me also read. Phil Corwin says, "Thanks to all for agreeing to a constructive approach on URS that negates the need to ask council for a charter change and leave self-management decisions to the working group." And he looks forward to the discussion. So, John, what you're talking about is kind of a write-up of what happened on the discussion today.
Essentially, just taking what Phil has stated and adding a little bit of detail to that so that, for instance, we can satisfy some of Susan's concerns and some of Paul's concerns and get that were raised, so kind of picking both sides here, that would for people to take a look at and discuss at one of the next meetings whenever that's held.
It looks like Paul and Julie are in the queue. Paul, then Julie. Paul Keating, please. Paul, if you're talking, we can't hear you. Julie, your hand is down now. Susan Payne, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. It was something I was going to raise at the end, but actually John's comment sort of touched on it. I wondered if it's possible to get an update on what the status is on the data gathering on the claims in Sunrise and so on, because obviously we know that there was an RFP issued, but I haven't heard if anyone's been appointed yet. And obviously I'd raised some concerns about
what I think is the need for some further work and discussion with whoever is appointed that I think that we need to take forward. So I just wondered what the status was, if someone could let me know, or let us know, rather.
Good question. This is because this is the Trademark Clearinghouse Data Subteam, which worked for a number of months on defining questions on the TMCH-related issues. Mary, do you want to provide us with an update? Everybody, I apologize for going over time, and I know we are over time. Mary, go ahead, please.
Sorry, this is Ariel Liang from staff. I think I can provide that update on behalf of the staff team. We are at the final stage of contracting with a selected vendor, and right now the contract is being reviewed by legal, and we do need their advice and be able to look through everything before we send it over to the vendor to sign the contract. And then at the same time, the vendor is filling out other forms to provide the other, such as like NDA and conflict of interest and other documents. So we're at the very final stretch of getting this vendor contracted. And hopefully by next week, we should be able to announce the vendor's name, but we cannot do that until everything is finalized. That's the brief update for now.
Thank you, Ariel. And I'll note that the co-chairs are, through the process, the co-chairs have no additional information. We have no idea who the finalists are or who ICANN is considering hiring for this important work. Let's see. Okay, it looks like Paul has posted. Paul, I'll read it in. I'm going to call on you, but you may have posted because you can't be heard right now.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay. Briefly, please.
I don't know what happened in the 2 seconds or so. Sorry about that. This is Paul Keating for the record. John, as I put into the chat, thank you for the compromise. But the only request I have is as I noted, that after working on it with staff, that you share it with the working group as a whole instead of having an added layer of co-chairs only, and then it just leaves the questions from everybody else. If it never sees the light of day, or if it does, under what conditions, et cetera, I'd rather be more transparent with it. That's my request. And also that you identify specific issues that you feel should be punted to phase two, and more importantly, why. I noted Phil's comment earlier that if we fail to achieve consensus, we'll to say something and will be by definition sent into the final report after phase two, but that's the condition for any issue that requires consensus. So that in and of itself, to me, is not a reason itself to punt, okay? So if you could take those into consideration, I welcome your offer to do the work.
And thank Phil, you. I note that your hand is not raised, but as co-chair, I was wondering if you have any comments you'd like to make.
Kathy, I pretty much put my comments in the chat if you or someone else has a specific question, but I think the bottom line is that, we'll get the answers back from the providers and practitioners, and we can kind of frame up what we think the administrative and operational versus policy issues are for URS, and then decide which ones we think are appropriate collectively, which ones we think are appropriate for resolution in phase one, and which ones we collectively agree should be deferred to phase two, or as a practical matter, if we don't have consensus for a decision one way or the other, they're by default deferred to phase two. So it's a bit of an escape valve that lets us get done what we can in phase one and put off other issues to phase two. That's my personal view of it. I don't want to be dictating to the working group, but I think it's much better to manage it among ourselves than asked for direction from the council, because we're a lot more familiar with these issues than they are.
And I think we're there. I think we're there.
Yeah.
And now the question is kind of what the process is in the working group and whether we determine the issues, if I understood John correctly, whether we determine the issues now that might be postponed versus after we've collected the data and after we've looked at it in the URS proceeding. I have to say, I don't think we're going to resolve this.
Kathy, on that, I think it would be much less divisive and much more informed and just a natural flow to make those decisions as we come to issues rather than starting to debate things now before we get any results back from providers and practitioners.
Thank you for your comments on that, Phil. And I think this is something we'll have to take to the list, what the next steps are. As a co-chair, I haven't thought through next steps, John, but as personally, I think that idea that we'll have more information later and can decide what to postpone and what not to, what really belongs in UDRP, URS, seems like it will be that then kind of in this initial URS review seems to be a decision that we might have more data with later, but that's an off the top of my head personal thought. I think we'll be continuing this on the list. We have covered a lot of things today. Congratulations to Brian Beckham, and thanks for coming on and joining us in what will be many meetings, both with co-chairs and staff and with the full working groups. Thank you to Rebecca, Tishnet, and Alex for, I apologize, Alex, I don't know your last name, for joining us and giving us an overview of research, and thanks to John. And for guiding us through the discussion and where we might go and the compromise that we appear to have reached. So thank you, everyone. Safe travels wherever you're heading in the next 2 weeks. Appreciate the call, and we'll continue online. Take care.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, everyone, for joining today. The meeting has been adjourned.